Quick straw poll, how many of you know what track is? How many of you are surprised I'm talking about it in a sysadmin session? Good. We'll try and skip through a lot of the introduction to track stuff, seeing as most of you got a fairly good idea of what it is, and we'll try and get to some of the things that you might find useful as sysadmins, ops, people. Now, what is track? It's a simple, lightweight project management framework. It's open source, BSD license. Widely used by a variety of open source projects, including Luke, who develops Puppet. It provides quite an integrated approach to managing process and projects. Ticketing, documentation, integrates quite well with Subversion for doing your version control. And one great thing is it's simple to install, configure, manage. It's a real nice, lightweight tool. It doesn't take a lot of training to get a team up to speed with it. But hang on, we're not developers, or are we? You write scripts, you change configurations, you've got lots of things you need to manage. And ideally, you want to version control them. And as was mentioned earlier, trying to persuade ops people to use version control can be interesting at best. And the ticketing facilities provide better visibility than just using tasks in your email folder or something. You know, you've actually got visibility across the team of what work's going on. And you do need to make sure your documentation stays up to date. As it's got a wiki type interface, you can constantly manage that living documentation for your team. And it's a lot more than just a simple bug tracker. Whilst its core focus is just around managing a project, why not make your operational team the project? If other groups within your company need to manage specific things, why not create them their own little stub track environments? It can be a great tool to use across the whole of your company. It's got quite a nice, simple web interface, easily skinnable. The timeline gives you visibility of everything that's been happening in track recently. Roadmap lets you set well-defined milestones and deliverables that you can then assign tasks to. Lots of things you can do with tickets. Read up here on the website. Creating a ticket, really quite simple. Put in a short summary, assign it to a component, set a priority, assign it to a team member. Version control leverages Subversion. It will use other version control tools, but some of that's a little flaky. It's got an excellent web-based browser and div tool for Subversion that in itself is quite invaluable for the team, for guys who really aren't that used to trying to type SVN diff. I won't cover installation, there's lots of great guides. Just a word of warning, make sure you use a reasonably recent version. There's some interesting bugs out there. And you can usually get environment up and running in about 30 minutes. Admin, really good guides on the track website on how to set up the environment. They're simple, good how-tos. User management, understand how you want to organize your team, organize your groups, assign people to groups, get your permission model right. There's a nice little plugin that's going to be part of Track 0.11, the standard, that simplifies a lot of that. So, how can we use it? And especially, how can we use it within an ops or sysadmin environment? First thing, use Track to set up Track. Start learning to use it straight away. As soon as you have something vaguely usable, start creating tickets about all the other things you want to use track for. For example, setting up your types and components. The default types it has set up are development focus, defect, enhancement, and task. And the components are merely simple example components. You want to just go in, rip them out, replace them immediately. Great thing about components is they allow auto assignment of specific tickets to team members immediately. And clearly defining your types and components means it's easy to produce reports. Oh, how many tickets are open for the web server team? How many tickets are open for the people managing user management? So some additional useful types in your environment might be change request, service order, new user account. And components might be authentication, system monitoring. And really, you should have a component in there for track, because you're going to want changes and tweaks, and they need to be assigned to somebody. Make sure you understand the syntax you can use within track. A and make sure your team understand it. There's some real simple syntax there. It uses fairly standard wiki camel case, which means any ticket, any subversion commit, anything you're doing immediately starts referencing the documentation automatically. It's easy to reference other tickets, hash ticket number. Subversion change sets can be referenced within your tickets, within your documentation. So everything starts linking to each other. And you can even link to specific paths within your subversion tree. So here's a simple example. You've got a new ticket, you want to build a new Apache virtual server for web application team, for Project Purple. So that ticket now automatically references the terms Project Purple, web application team. Those wiki pages probably need to exist for the purposes of your documentation, and they're now auto-referenced. And then when you perform the work, you really should keep that updated Apache configuration under version control. So you commit it with an appropriate message. And again, you're referencing the documentation, you're referencing your tickets. But you can actually automate a lot of the extra referenceability by using this post-commit hook and subversion. It's fun to try and get working the very first time, but it's well worth it because a simple syntax lets you auto-update tickets as you do subversion commits. This becomes habit-forming very quickly. Based off our earlier example, we now just change the syntax slightly. Apache configuration for Project Purple references ticket 57 and closes 91. Those two tickets will now be auto-updated as part of your subversion commit. When you go back and reference the tickets, they're going to link to the subversion commit, and they're going to have that commit message embedded as a comment in the ticket. So you've got now a trail of all the work associated with it. All your commits are in your tickets. And don't commit without a ticket. If what are you doing that's so unimportant that means you need to commit a change without actually having a ticket open? And even capturing some simple tasks that you may have to go back and repeat at a later date, at least then you can go back and reference the old ticket. And it looks quite good. Sometimes you've closed quite a lot of tickets today, especially if a manager's keeping an eye on those reports. Avoid bad documentation naming standards. Use version control. Yes, subversion's not brilliant for managing documents, but if you've got no document management system, it can still be invaluable. You want to go back a couple of releases of a document, it's all there. And now you can track who's been working on the document changes. None of these emails with 20 and 30 megabyte attachments because they've got 18 versions of the documents. Go just forward it on and on and on. You can always find the version you want. And it really does simplify sharing documents across your team. And you can even reference the older documents within the syntax that Track provides. At 57 means look at version 57 of that document. And use text format files for a lot of things that you want to keep in subversion, because of course it can handle them a lot more efficiently. And it can do really cool diffs. So if you're keeping track of configuration changes or state of systems, don't put them in Excel files or other DAF formats. Keep them in really simple CSV files. And that's great because you can now just compare changes over time. You can see why a particular system has stopped behaving. Oh yeah, well we upgraded the following RPMs on this box and now it no longer boots, or Apache doesn't work, or SSL isn't behaving. We know what to roll back to. And make sure you back it up. It's really easy. It's really painless. It's live. It's got a hot backup mechanism. And they're really easy to restore from. There's some cool plugins out there. Don't mess about with them too much. You want a stable environment, but it's worth having a look. What's not so good with Track? Administration is still a bit of a pain. A lot of it's got to be done on the command line. Track admin plugin makes that a lot easier, but there's a lot of work on in 0.11. Permissions model is a real bugger. If you want to prevent your managers looking at selected documentation or other teams referencing each other's work, that needs a lot of improvement. There's some work in 0.11, but it's still not really there. There's some good changes in workflow. If you need an approval process, you can now modify the workflows and add extra workflow steps. And there's a couple of little inconsistencies. Again, they're being tidied up at the moment. There's enhancements for additional database support. It currently uses SQLite and additional version control systems.
Thank you, Stephen.
I've got the mic before I run off.
Hi, my name's Joel. I'm just going to do a fairly brief talk on some OpenBSD related tools. I was going to go into OpenBGP, but probably would run me short of time. So I'll go into CARP, which is Common Address Redundancy Protocol, which is actually, I guess, closely related. Oh, sorry, then we've got PF, which is OpenBSD Packet Filter. Probably, in my opinion, it's only my opinion, that a little bit easier syntax in that it's more human readable than IP tables. Opinions may vary. And pfSync, which is closely related. We'll get into that next slide. Okay, CARP's been around since OpenBSD 3.5, so almost 4 years now. And it's a free replacement for VRRP and HSRP, which were encumbered with protocols from a fairly large vendor. I'm not sure of the patent status on that at the moment. What it does is basically shares your IPs with multiple machines in a redundancy group. And by default, it's basically a failover situation where if one machine fails, it will take over. Masters continue sending out advertisements to let the failover machines know that it's still alive, and they're protected by SHA-1 hashes. Okay. Configuration of CARP is fairly straightforward. It's a virtual interface. So configure with ifconfig. Pretty straightforward. You've got your interface name, virtual host ID, which tells it what group it's in for the redundancy. Other hosts will have the same ID. Shared password, that must be the same across all the hosts. You can actually specify an individual device. By default, it's multicast, but you can specify unicast. For example, if you wanted to, well, generally you'd have its own network for the syncing, but you can actually have it on the same network, protected by something like IPsec. You can also got tunable parameters via syscontrol, for example. You need to switch it on first. By default, it's got CARP 0, the default generic kernel. That's what the ifconfig output looks like down the bottom. This one's from the backup node. You've got advertised base and SKU, which basically allows you to set up which ones are a master, which one's a slave. All right, so now we'll move into pfSync. Sorry, you've got pfSync 0 by default. So you can monitor that with TCP dump. For setting up redundant firewalls, you'd need to send it over the network, obviously, to a different host. are usually configured on the on its own segment, as I mentioned previously. So we can use sync peer to tell it to unicast. All right, so looks like I didn't copy across my diagram to the USB stick. Basically, it was just a text diagram anyway. Might be on the next slide, here's hoping. No. Basically, it's just two firewalls with a shared link, bridging the two for the synchronization traffic. Pretty straightforward then, because each box has three interfaces. You've got one for the private LAN, one for the external LAN. Sure. That's a very good question. I don't believe so. Well, the question was, does the PF sync connection also transfer the PF rules, packet filter rules? I'm not sure. I don't think so, no. So basically, it's just for failover for states, so that if the master host dies completely, one of the slaves, I suppose, or the backup routers will take over without dropping a connection. Just some more notes on redundancy. You can use route redundancy. OpenBSD have another shoot-off project, OpenBGP, and switch redundancy using bridging and spanning tree protocol. Further reading, man pages, they're quite good in BSD, so quite detailed FAQ also on OpenBSD's website. And also a use case on that counter siege link. And also, I realise CARP has been ported to Linux. Gentoo documentation is quite good on that as well. Any more questions?
Thanks, Joel. Next up, we have Tommy Young. Tommy is going to talk to us about how the team uses DOT projects to achieve efficient project management goals in an RDC. Thanks, Tommy.
Hello. Hello, everyone. My name is Tommy, and I'm coming from the HP Open Source and Linux organization in China. I'm a non-native English speaker, so be patient, please. So first of all, have anybody here heard about the DOT project? OK, that's great. And how many people have been using the project management software daily? Oh, not a lot. Okay. So when I am in the small R&D team, we have met several difficulties or challenges to manage a small projects. You know, this is a typical diagram in a project management scope. There are stakeholders. They hope to know the entire project status and the resource situations, the issues. And the project managers hope to define and track and report his or her projects periodically. And the team members also hope to know his tasks and record his thing, that is, status, accomplishment, issues, and escalation next steps without conflict logs. That means if multiple persons are editing the same file, there could be some conflict. Among the three roles, there are tens of meetings, emails, and conference calls, face-to-face. So a lot of communication works, which is pretty much pain. Yeah, and after some investigation, we figure out that the dot project software can address most of our concerns. So what is the dot project? It's an online browser server based project management software and under GPL license and hosted in .NET website and SourceForge as well. It is a LAMP-based applications, and that means have lower admin cost. And it has several hundreds of downloads per day. So the benefits. What? Oh, no, it's browser server. BS, browser server architecture. No, it's comparing with CS, just a browser and server. Yeah, sorry. Again, I'm a native, not a native. Okay. Okay. Okay, so the benefits to the project managers, so he can know the entire progress well and based on the task members' input. And you know, from this diagram, the red part means overdue tasks, and the yellow part means tasks should have started but have not. So it's pretty clear from a PM point of view to see what's going on. And another benefit it could provide solid data. So the red parts in this slide, the data is coming from the dot project. So it shows the completion, the project completion rate, the tasks finish the completion rate, and the upcoming checkpoints, and the issues. And additionally, the PM can see the duration that he or she plan and what is actually spent, because the team members need to input how much hours he worked or she worked, and the left picture shows what are the lags between the planning and the reality. That is a good reference to the PM. And on the right side is the resource utilization. So consider a manager or PM hope to know in the following 2 months how much engineering resource bandwidth is available. So the dot project can provide a rough number about how many bandwidth it can be used. And to each team member, first of all, this software can avoid the conflict lock. So you don't need to worry about so multiple persons are modifying the same data. And also know everyone can know his or her status from the dot project. For example, in this picture, I can know all of my unfinished tasks. And last, it can reduce the unnecessary communications. Other benefits, it can import a MS project XML file and have some tickets such has same functionality like Bugzilla. It also have permission controls so that not everybody can see all the data which the product team may care about. So it's not ideal as well. There are some risks. For example, some reports are not accurate or are not act as expected or as designed. There are some defects in some of the reports. And the task dependencies, like in Microsoft Project, does not work pretty well and need some improvement. So how was this software picked out? So we just Google project management tool open source, and it's on one of the top candidates. And we have several comparison criteria, and we just list them out and compare the existing tools we have and several candidates, and finally decide to use the dot project. So try it out, and it's online on the web.
Want to give Luke's presentation for him? So, all right, looks like we've got a bit of a disaster going on. Are there any backup talks out there? Buttons and you tell me what to say.
I have not seen this slide deck. Well, maybe I did.
There you go.
Use the source, Luke.
Okay. I am not Luke. I have seen this talk last year, probably, and I have used Puppet. I used Puppet for a project in a large multinational company to implement a security policy across about 9 POSIX OSs, including AX 5.2 and 5.3, Solaris 2.6 through to Solaris 10, Debian, CentOS, Red Hat 3, Red Hat 4. And we had a single set of configuration data for all of those OSs, and we had one resolve.conf that was applied automatically for every system in the building, which is pretty cool. Okay. All right. So, Luke is giving this talk later in the week, I understand.
No, this is how to do it on a single machine, and he's giving a bigger public talk later in the week.
Okay. I don't want to... You should all go to Luke's talk regardless of what I say. Right.
Are you going to be there?
I'll be hiding or in a bloody mess because, Luke, thank God you're here.
Jesus. Sorry about that. I was looking at the schedule and I wasn't on it, so I guess I was looking at the wrong one. So the idea behind this was to talk about using Puppet in ways that people don't normally use Puppet. It was written as a client-server kind of application where you use it to manage lots of machines and It's not something you would use on your own machine. But the truth is that it was written very flexibly, and the application models that I always talk about aren't the only application models that are available. So, as an example, I have a simple recipe in my bin directory that I use to create the span processing links, or span processing cron jobs that both I use and everyone else on my mail server uses. So this isn't something that I run centrally. This is just when I log into a machine that I want to manage, that I want to add these on, I do this. It's very simple, and it's not, there's no server running anywhere. I run this, I just execute this directly, and then I have, in that script, I basically just have all the code that I want to ever run, and I think for a given host, I say, well, if I'm on this host, then it's, you know, it's a mail client and a mail server, and therefore behave differently, but on the mail clients, just do this one little bit. And that's pretty much using Puppet's language and the normal code you'd use in Puppet, but using it a little bit differently, which is basically everything's the same except for the application model. There's no client server, it's just right there. But you get a little bit more strange, and one of the things that really differentiates Puppet from the tools around it is that it has real modeling. It models resources, and it can talk about those resources in a very generic and abstract way. And normally people use the language to do that. How much time do I have? 20 minutes. Okay, I'll slow down then. All right. So, because somebody said 10 earlier. So, you look at like something like CF Engine, and CF Engine can talk about files and it can talk about packages, but it doesn't have a low-level model to do that. So, if you wanted to talk about files and packages in a different way than CF Engine's language, then you couldn't do that. With Puppet, though, it's got this library that you can have however you'd like to interact with that library. It's an API. So you have this resource-level API into the system that works in completely different ways. So this is, RALSH is a resource abstraction layer shell, is what it's an acronym for, kind of. And the idea is that instead of having Puppet's code, you can just interact directly with this resource library. So this is the output of asking RALSH what the Luc user looks like. And you can do slightly more interesting things with RALSH. And what it's printing out is it's printing out that user in Puppet code. So one of the things, you can take Puppet, you can take this tool and essentially cat any resource that Puppet knows how to manage on any machine on your network, put that into a file, copy that to another machine in your network and execute that file, and you've effectively copied that resource around. So using something like this, you can copy users from one host to another as easily as you can copy files. You can copy packages from one host to another. You can copy services, or you can copy a whole set of resources. You can easily set up a simple query that says, you know, I'm interested in these resources. What do they look like? Cut that whole thing into a file, copy that to another machine, and execute it. And this is very different from the kind of centralized management that I would normally recommend. You know, you really want to have an authoritative system managing your entire network, but sometimes it's not feasible, sometimes it's not what you want, sometimes it's not interesting. So this is a simple example of me. I literally ran this morning, so this is the output's a little bit doctored, so there's not as much stuff in there, and it mostly fits on the slide. But otherwise, I basically, I should have. So the key here is that I'm saying create this user, so ensure equals present is kind of like Puppet, the command line language for saying create this user. Make sure this user is here. So it creates the user, and then it fills in all the default values, which basically is just using user add, picks the user add's values. And you can see that it actually does create the user. In the same way, you can use this tool to modify users. Some of the output got cut off. But again, this isn't using Puppet's language. It's a completely different application model. So I think it's a little bit interesting to do that. And then, of course, you can remove users, too. This isn't quite as much. So this same API, though, the same ability to go into, to interact with this resource, this set of resources, via a different tool, there's actually a network-based API that does the same thing. So you can actually, you can start the Puppet agent, with a couple of special arguments, and then connect to that agent over XMLRPC and query any resources Puppet knows how to manage. And again, if you have two agents running on two different machines, you could query a set of resources from one machine, and then send those resources to the other machine and apply them directly. And that code's all available right now, and it's all working because of the focus on building that client model. So that's mainly what I wanted to talk about. And I haven't found a good way to talk about why this is so interesting. And the silence in the crowd implies that I still have not succeeded. But
why so, demo?
a live demo on a machine that I don't know how to use. Let's see. I don't think so. This isn't my computer. It doesn't have Puppet installed on it. So, question? So, archiving, like Puppet is not very good at managing lots and lots of files. That's not what it's meant to do. And so you could certainly use Puppet to figure out what that user's UID is very easily. If you had Puppet's agent running on it, then you could do that remotely via, again, an XML RPC call. If you wanted to then connect to the box and get the files, I would recommend using something like, oh my God, I've got way too much time. Using something like rsync to actually get the files. But you could use Puppet pretty easily too. And again, it depends on what your needs are. So do you want to write an application that has the ability to do this? Or do you want to just write a small, you know, a one-liner shell script that does this? You want a one-liner shell script. So one of the things that, I don't know that Puppet is very good for one-liner shell scripts. I've definitely focused in my development on making it so that it's either a pretty comprehensive tool that does what it does pretty well, or it's something that developers can use and write new applications. For that kind of thing, you could use Roush to pull the UID pretty easily in your one-liner, but then after that, you know, if you're going to do that, if you need to be cross-platform, then that's useful. I guess I didn't mention this. So this tool works on, today, this would work for you on OS X, Debian, Red Hat, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, NetBSD, SUSE, Solaris, and I believe it might work on HPUX, but not AIX or something like that. So that's one of the nice things about this abstraction layer is that it really is abstract. It manages these resources on lots and lots of platforms. And if that platform is missing, it's usually, I think the longest provider we've had to write is 200 lines to provide packaging for some ungodly platform. So it's worth going into this if you've got cross-platform problems. It's worth going into this if you're trying to build what amounts to an API into an operating system, or if you want to take advantage of this abstraction across lots of platforms. Are there any other questions? Puppet's dependencies right now are the Ruby programming language, and it has a single very small program called Factor that is another tool that I wrote. That's the only external dependency besides everything that ships with Ruby, unless you're running on Debian, because they don't think that you need OpenSSL when you use Ruby, so you need to install that too, but it's essentially Ruby and Factor are the only dependencies. Question in the back? To do what? Yeah, his point is that you could write a webmin replacement. And that's actually exactly why I wrote this in the first place, was to demonstrate the ability to essentially replace 90% of webmin in, you know, 5 lines of code. And I successfully did that, and everyone went, ugh. So, yeah, it's been 2 years, and I've been trying to talk about this and get people interested in something other than the standard application model. And yeah, I think that's exactly the point. I had a Rails application that you could exactly navigate to any host and look at any resources on any host, and I didn't enable at the time because I didn't have a good security model, but you could have edited any of those resources, removed them, added them, anything like that. It's all right there. All the code is done. All that's necessary to make that actually work is have the web interface and an application and a security model. There's a question right there. It is not. So the talk I'm going to do later this week, the idea is to cover mostly how to use Puppet. So I've done previous talks about what Puppet is and why Puppet exists, and I'm trying to focus a lot more practically on how you can actually use Puppet to solve problems and how you get started on Puppet. It won't be an incredibly... It won't have a lot of assumptions about what you know, is the best way I would say. I don't know if I'm going to cover that or not. So the reasons you should use Puppet, for me, there are quite a few reasons. One of them is that there's a chance I can make money if you do. So that's a very good reason. But also because, so it's things like this. Puppet actually has a model for managing resources. It's not ad hoc. It's not like, so CF Engine, you've got very low-level files, and then you've got very high-level text editing skills, and the model is, they're not related at all. You can't really tell what's going on when you look at CF engine code. I believe Puppet is the only tool out there that has a single consistent model. You can take any resource Puppet knows how to manage and be assured that that resource has pretty much a limited scope, a limited domain, and it translates directly to something you're managing on that host. You don't have something that looks like a package in one case, but then does 1,000 other things in some other cases. It's not going to go edit your SAML.cf files in random ways. So that's one good reason. Another good reason is that we've actually got a very active and very open development community. According to olo.net, we've got more than 20 developers. If you look at, say, CF Engine, there are only two committers to CF Engine. One of them is Mark Burgess, and the other one is Root. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that one's Mark too. And another thing is that because I'm hoping to make money on this, because I'm trying to make a living based on this product, which I think is the way a lot of open source should be done, if this sucks, then I don't eat. So it's incumbent upon me to make this not suck. It's incumbent upon me to make this so that when a customer uses this, when a user uses this, and it sucks for them, then I have to do my best to solve that problem. Because if I don't, then the product doesn't succeed, but also I don't succeed like economically. My wife gets really upset when we have to scrape the floor for mold or whatever. So I think those are pretty big things. The closed development community in CF Engine is definitely what drove me away. But the inability to have a clear model for the things that I was managing is what caused me to start from scratch. Because I'd actually forked CF Engine initially and decided that it was too much work to impose a model on the code that he already had. And it was better value to start from scratch, create a new model, and force that model on the whole thing. So one of the things that Puppet can guarantee you is the resources that I'm managing, the code that I'm using to manage these resources, will not touch your systems unless you want it to. If you're telling it, look, I want to run a dry run mode, don't actually make any changes. Because I've got a transaction that interacts with that model through a fixed API, I know that that's the case. It's not like we're not doing an opaque handoff to like a chunk of code that we don't understand. We have very fixed APIs between the transaction and the resources. So you have a lot more control. You're guaranteed that if Puppet changes something, you get a log that says that. So those are what I would say are the reasons, which sound pretty abstract. But question in the back?
You've shown that with Rails, you can get information down. Is it possible with Puppet to do something like through the hardware, get that report on the hardware, even though you can't actually change it?
So the question was if you can get a report on the hardware back. So that's actually what Factor does. Factor's real job is to produce what amounts to a hash of attributes and it's very easy to teach Factor how to collect new information about a host, but its job is to say, what do I know about myself, and pass that up to the Puppet compiler. I am a big believer in separation of responsibilities, and I would say that that's where that belongs there. Maybe you're talking about things like hard disks, where clearly you're not going to make a new hard drive. You could teach Puppet to query the system about hardware-level resources and then just leave off any ability to sync. None of that exists today, but it certainly could exist. The question is if there's any integration with monitoring, and this is apparently the last question. There are many people who have done lots of interesting integrations between Nagios and Munin and other tools like that. And Puppet has some tools within it to make it easy for the host you're monitoring to tell the Nagios server how to monitor it. I'm an LDAP server, you should monitor this port. I'm a web server, you should monitor that port. That stuff is still a little bit fledgling, but people are using it in production today. And it's not something that Puppet integrates with Nagios for you. It's something that you code Puppet how to Nagios. It's not complicated, but it's a very general framework. So I don't have specific integration with any of those tools, but many people have already created that integration. So, and I think that's it. And one more thing, James Turnbull just wrote a book about Puppet. So he wrote the book on it. It's available on PDF right now and becomes available in print on February 4th. A-Press.
Okay, we've got 10 minutes now for moving between theaters. At 2:30, we've got Bruce and Tommy on Open LDAP Enterprise.